Welcome back, dear seekers of health, happiness, and harmonious cosmic humming, to season two of The Pebble in the Cosmic Pond. I'm Sabine Wilms, owner of Happy Goat Productions, in collaboration with Leo Locke, our self-proclaimed purveyor of multiple perspectives. As always, we're here to bring you old and new stories about China's healing traditions and about capital M medicine in heaven and on earth and in the sweet spot in between. In a special twist for our season two, we focus on second generation immigrant Asian voices by, for, and about women in that sweet spot in between traditional Asian wisdom and contemporary Western embodiment. And yes, Leo and I do realize that we need help with this theme, since both Leo and I are first and not second generation immigrants in the US. He from Malaysia and I from Germany. And he's a guy and I'm not Asian. That's where our interview partners come in. For today's episode on living and teaching the way of yin, Leo and I are once again joined by Chris Gonzalez, Chinese medicine practitioner and herbalist, whose personal experience of motherhood has been influenced by her Korean mother and her Mexican mother-in-law. In addition to her clinical practice, she's also an educator offering evocative courses on topics like embodied menstruation, holistic breast care, the alchemy of perimenopause, spirit-heart-womb transformation through the somatic womb path, and sacred vaginal ecology, to name just some of her juicy offerings. Check out her gorgeous website, thewayofyin.com, to get a sense of the beauty she weaves into being in her corner of the universe. In this second half of our conversation with Chris, we considered a yin approach to Chinese medicine. How do we shift out of the heady yang space and the intellectual models of Chinese medicine as it is currently practiced and taught in the West into the sensorial embodied experience that serves as such a potent alternative doorway to healing? How can we manifest a more expansive, softer, deeper, gentler, and less rigid healing practice that aims to lean into and support what feels good rather than fighting what is wrong? How can we express the yin way of weaving community and nurturing health instead of the yang way of solving problems? Ultimately, how can we change this extractive culture of ours through the authority and power of our medicine to restore the valuation of yin in all aspects of society, from menstruating and giving birth to cooking and caring? What a conversation. I am really happy that I get to share it with you, and I hope that this will in turn inspire you to engage in similar conversations with your community of family and friends as we all celebrate being over the moon, or maybe with a question mark. What do I know? Before we get started, I'd like to remind you to sign up for my newsletter at happygoatproductions.com/connect to get notified of new episodes, publications, courses, and other offerings of mine. And please rate, review, and share this podcast wherever you can. Also, check out the show notes if you want to learn more. There are a bunch of links on there. Okay, thank you and enjoy. This is a follow-up conversation, and Kristen, I just loved how in our previous conversation, just to bring everybody up to speed, I love how you you have a deep appreciation for Yangshan, I feel like, for nurturing life. And that I'm interested in, I feel like that is your, in a way, that's your special contribution. That's what makes your practice and the way you talk about Chinese medicine, to me, that Yangshan piece flows into the way you present and presumably practice Chinese medicine in a way that makes me feel all warm and cuddly, because that's what I see in the classics. The way you just put it earlier, how did you say it? Chinese medicine provides wellness, not just treats disease. You just tossed it out there, and it's like, boom, that is such a huge piece, and it sounds so simple, but it's such a profound shift in perspective, especially when we are talking about women's bodies and reproductive medicine. Like, what does it mean in your practice? And I feel like your practice really embodies that ideal when you talk about the potential of Chinese medicine, or how you're treating your patients, this ideal that you're empowering them to have a more balanced, healthier, more abundant experience in their body, as opposed to just treating disease. It's such a fundamental shift in perspective. So I thought Leo would love to love this conversation, because I see that in your perspective too, Leo. And now I guess my question is, how did you get to that point? And maybe you don't even know, because it's just who you are. Like, what were the influences that led you to? I feel like you have a special way of looking at Chinese medicine.
I almost feel like Leo and I have something in common here. It's like, how can you? How can you make the biggest impact with the, how did you frame it earlier? With the least effort.
The Bodhisattva man.
You framed it. I think that's so beautiful. And I wonder if that's kind of the underlying or the through line in my mission in life is, I can only see so many patients in my clinic. I can't see everybody. And so I feel like I have almost been gifted, this perspective of Chinese medicine that I have to share it. I have to share it because I feel like it has such a potential to truly be the model for true holistic wellness. Where I feel like a lot of holistic practitioners, I think maybe try to strive to be that, you know, you have like your nutritionists and you have your, you know, all the different kinds of holistic practitioners out there. But I feel like our medicine is the one that everybody references all the time. So it's like, oh, in Chinese medicine, they say this, or in this classic, they say this. And our medicine is referenced all the time by other holistic practitioners. So I want to live in that integrity of our medicine. And I want other practitioners of our medicine to feel that deep integrity, because it truly is a model that is holistic. And it's about prevention and vitality and longevity if we just know how to tap into it. And I think there's sometimes it feels a little overwhelming with all the theoretical things, and maybe that it is in Chinese. But I feel like there's ways to approach and understand and contextualize our medicine in a way that feels embodied that we are like living embodiments of this holistic model. And it just takes kind of a tapping in, you know.
I just have this image when you're saying that, of this taproot, of this root going down. And it just popped in my head when you were saying, you just throw it out there. But it's actually a very, very powerful image of a root finding this patch of just fertile soil. And it just comes out on top into this beautiful, lush, healthy plant where the bugs can't affect it.
Yeah. I love that imagery. Yes.
I think I noticed something, a very important aspect from our previous conversation with Chris, is that, Chris, you touched upon something, you said sensory, right? You talk about how you learn sensorially when you're growing up. Yeah? And I think that's, for me, that is the doorway into Chinese medicine. And that's what sets our medicine apart from all the other holistic things or models, because many of these models are based on thinking, on the intellect, on this particular kind of theory. Well, Chinese medicine, we have our theory too, but we have our embodiment first. Our theory grows on the soil of sensorial data. Yeah, the tree of Chinese medicine is not based on mind-based thoughts or intellectual models. It's based on what the hands can touch, what the eyes can see, and what the ears can hear. And this whole sensorial territory and texture of life.
Leo, this is really important. What you just said is really, it's because we have these doctoral programs and people are learning like amazing details about formula analyses and it's all very intellectual and it's so sophisticated and it's really impressive. But sometimes I feel like there's a spirit that's missing. And I think you just nailed it. I think the two of you are just, and I think that's why I'm like, I wanted to have this conversation with the two of you. Leo, that was beautiful. And Chris, you too, the two of you.
I got chills.
Yeah.
Well, I'm inspired by Chris's, you know, explanation of how she became this way, when, you know, how she grew up that way. I think that is at the basis of the lineage. The lineage really is about, that's how I learned from my mother, my late mother too. You know, she would say, oh, I just took, you know, your second aunt just made this sour veggie pork dish and I took a little bit and then my uterus hurt. It's too cold for my uterus.
Yeah,
it's like that. The reason I think some of our colleagues, especially our male colleagues, who went really intellectual is because they didn't have the experience of that embodiment transmission. So the only way they can get to the medicine is through the intellectualization of the medicine. And I'm not saying that is not useful. In very specific cases, for a particular demographic, that is actually quite useful. And we have a long tradition of that. So this is in no way or any means dismissing or belittling that part of them, that spectrum of our medicine, which is really powerful. And they can be life-saving in critical conditions and complex cases. But that is only a spectrum, a segment of the entire continuum of the possibility of Chinese medicine. right? The entire landscape mm-hmm. of our tradition, that's maybe a particular garden. We have the meadows and the mountains and the oceans as well.
Oh, yeah, I love.
Right, and, yeah. and sensorial input and processing, like a poet, like an artist. Mm-hmm. I think to me, that is the fundamental ground and of our medicine, everything. So that's why, you know, if, you know, I have heard a practitioner, for example, after decades of practice, still ask questions like, oh, how does Changzhu move in the body? Because I read that Changzhu goes up and does this, but then I read Changzhu goes down and does this. Does it enter the gallbladder channel? You know, the more they read, the more confused sometimes they become. So my reaction to that is, you mean you cannot feel how what Changzhu does to your body? You know, this is not to belittle the experience of our colleagues, but just I'm trying to point out the dilemma, the incredible challenges if we only go by non-sensorial data, if we only go by what's written in the books. Because there are many opinions and many experiences, and then sometimes the more people read, the more confused they become.
Hmm.
Sometimes it happens. The more they practice, the more confused they become, because they have a lot too much, to me, conflicting intellectual data, but not enough clarifying sensorial impressions and experience.
Mm. Yeah, it's making me think about our profession, like meta level. In the schools, it feels like there's only one path for us. It's to be a clinician. That's the only path that you have written for you. And I think lately I think also after the pandemic, as practitioners, we need to think outside of the box and mm-hmm. what other things we can do with our knowledge.
Mm.
And I think that's kind of my, it's like, where I've kind of branched off a little bit. Yes, I'm a clinician, but what else can I contribute with the knowledge that I've been gifted with? And I think maybe that's what's missing, this kind of inspiration at the school level and even the alumni level. And like, what else can we share about our medicine other than the clinic model? So I wonder if that's maybe why we're so heady, is that there's only one path written for us. There's no other possibility other than you working as a clinician. And so there's almost like this real ask of like, be a business owner and a healer, you know, which almost kind of forces us to be in this heady space and not in this embodied space. And yeah, I wonder if we can maybe shift that a little bit in our profession, and that there's so many other ways that we can share our medicine.
As somebody who used to be a professor at a Chinese medicine college, how do you test these other skills? Like, really, I think the emphasis on intellectual knowledge is partly based on the fact if we transmit medical knowledge in institutions in large classes, and we have a culture where we need to license people and they need to go through that testing, because otherwise anybody can hang out a shingle. And there's a huge fear of lawsuits, of imposters, of flakes, all of these other things. How do you test whether somebody can whether somebody can conduct chi through their body? Right? So it makes sense that the intellectual stuff, that's what's written, that's what you can speak, that's testing. So it's what textbooks explain. That's just unfortunate. I think a lot of it is the limitations of the institutional model of transmitting knowledge, which is why we are so interested in this transmission outside the institutional setting, like with you from your mom and your mother-in-law, and from you, Leo. And now my question is, how do we communicate? How do we encourage practitioners of Chinese medicine who don't have the good fortune of having grown up with a Korean mom? How do Western practitioners of Chinese medicine learn that peace? I mean, some people can do, they find themselves, I'm just thinking of my students who I really value. They tend to have very long, deep relationships with elder Chinese or East Asian practitioners who they've worked with very closely for many, many years in a disciple, master-disciple sort of model. But that's kind of hard to find, and not everybody gets to do that.
Just out here.
So how do you pass that kind of knowledge on? I mean, here we are doing a podcast, which is something. But Leo, you're doing those classes, your little online courses. So that's your attempt, I suppose.
One of my attempts. And I think we need to have more conversations like the one that we're having now, and more collaborations. Because we're inspired by each other. You know, it's really just going back to the more feminine approach, if we can use that label. The return of a little bit more of the matriarchy. That's why I encourage women, female practitioners, to really stand up and speak up about their experiences. Because both in the biomedical model, or even in the transmission of the Chinese medicine, sometimes is very male dominated. Is very intel, perhaps Chinese medicine a lot less so than biomedical, but it's still very male dominated. Right? We see a lot of our practitioners being women, but most of the teachers are male. Have you noticed that?
And it was actually, Leo, it was one of the reasons why I became so close to my friend Lillian Bridges, who died 2 years ago. When we first met each other at a conference like 20 years ago or something, it was like we both just zoomed in, like we were just like, oh my God, we were so glad we found each other. Because other than that, there's somebody, like the women were teaching facial cosmetic acupuncture or how to be pretty or sexual cultivation, but not as a health cultivation, but as a weird, like a, I don't know. But yeah, the serious teachers were all men, and they were looking at us like they were very condescending. But I think it has changed.
I think that's part of the journey of transmission of knowledge. It is time now for women to really, women colleagues, to really speak out and about their experience and their wisdom.
So, Chris, what are your dreams? What are your visions for speaking out?
I think we talked about this, but
I would have
never thought that I would be where I am today. You know, in high school, I got most bashful. You know how they have those senior standouts. So, you know, if you would have told me in high school that, you know, when I'm in my 40s, I'm going to be a teacher or practitioner who is invited to a podcast to speak, I would be like, no way. I was so nervous to just use my voice. And I think lately there's a passion that just is too strong. And so I've learned to kind of face the fear and the discomfort of being seen and being heard, because what I have to say is so important. It's so important to share. So I think conversation, like Leo was saying, is really important. And I wonder also, like, just thinking outside the box, you know, and I think a lot of how our medicine functions is very much in kind of this Western structured way. But what if we just kind of burst through that, you know, bubble and, just really inhabit that integrity of our medicine and just not be afraid that it doesn't fit in a pretty little box of structure. I think conversation and thinking outside of the box, rooting in integrity, and maybe a little bit more of a yin approach to our medicine.
Okay, speak about
that. I love all of those ideas.
Now you opened another box. And I have to say, Chris, and that's what I picked up when we had that first conversation. You're on your golden path. Mm. And that's why you're overcoming your bashfulness. And I can say that because I was exactly the same way. And I think, I don't know, Leo, if you're like that too, but it's like, I can't believe I'm doing this podcast. It's kind of like, what? It's not really in my personality either. But I do feel strongly, and you do too, Leo, right? Like, that's what connects us, that we feel like there's this potential for Chinese medicine to be so much more effective than it is. And there are these beautiful practitioners who are doing it, and we want to support that and let it flourish and make it visible. And it's so clear that you're on your, what Lillian used to call, you're on your golden path. So we're just gonna,
so maybe like a yin approach. I mean, just to use your word, like matriarchal, you think of the care about the community, you care about the wellness of each individual. Maybe it's not so, it's more nurturing, more loving. And so maybe approaching it that way through more connection with our fellow practitioners, building community, having conversations, swimming in poetic conversations, supporting one another, which this feels like right here, you know? So way more of this type of approach. And that the sharing of our medicine doesn't have to always be in an academic setting. It could be more from the ground up, you know. Starting with our own communities as individual practitioners and then collaborating with each other on ideas of how to share in our communities. It could just blossom from there.
I totally agree. One way of thinking outside the box that I have been thinking about and doing it is take a lot less like a pathology oriented approach, right? Because the pathology orientation is a very male dominant model. What kind of problems do you have? Let me solve it for you right now. Right? That's the male way. Male brains are built, you know, oriented and cultured to solve problems. If there's not a problem, I'm not interested. Right? So kind of the more feminine
you tell us, approach, Lou.
The yin approach is like what Chris said, nurturing. We nurture the community before there is a problem.
So instead of asking, what's your problem, ask, how can I nurture you?
Yeah, how do you feel? Oh. How can I support you? What kind of life do you want to have? Do you want to have a more physical, vital life? You want to have a more harmonious, loving, nurturing relationship? Do you want your children to be vibrant and calm? You know, that is sort of like, what is the positive outcome? What kind of life qualities do we want to have? So more into like a sort of a life coaching, health coaching role, rather than a pathologist, a clinician who solves problems, health problems. But isn't that the ideal of our medicine to begin with, is to fix the problems before it arises?
Prevention.
Yeah. But prevention not in the male dominant oriented way, but from the more feminine yin way. And we looked at, so that is the approach I've been looking at this whole thing of rethinking how we can contribute aside from being a clinician, from my clinical experience.
You know,
right?
My friend Lillian always said, and she told this to my daughter, who is an activist. She said, you can't, and she told this to me, you can't be running away from things. You have to have something positive to go towards. So you can't just protest all the things that are wrong. If you're going to be an activist, it's a negative way. You have to have a vision. The revolutions, the social movements that succeed are the ones that don't just fight against what's wrong, but that fight for what something positive that they're building, that they're creating. And what you're saying is exactly along those lines. Which is totally not the medical model. It's not the way insurance works. It's not, I mean, in a way, it's the way public health works. That's why I think public health, when I talk to Western or whatever mainstream public health people, they seem to have more of that awareness.
Yeah. There's, I have a really good friend who's like a nervous system, would you call it an expert? Nervous system practitioner, somatic practitioner. And what you said about leaning in to what feels good or what is good is a way of helping our nervous system have a frame of reference, like a barometer. It just reminded me of that. Just like it's also important to lean into what's good and feels good. Yeah.
and returning us, mm-hmm. not returning, but more modeling after how traditionally and even, you know, even in historic and prehistoric time, how women tend to weave together the community, right? A bunch of women with the children, you know, making food, talking to each other while the men go hunting in the forest and the jungles, right?
And talk about postpartum recovery.
Yeah.
In that context, right?
Right.
The mother-in-law and the mother, mm-hmm. everybody is taking care of the newborn baby and yeah. taking over the cooking and the laundry and the household duties so that the new mom can just rest. And that's no longer happening. I mean, I wish I had had that awareness.
Guilt. Not feel guilt in the rest.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it almost is seen as like a luxury or something, where birthing, as you know, is a very exhaustive, rite of passage, I would call it. It's a rite of passage, and it's no easy feat. And there's so much Jing allocation to that whole process of conceiving and caring and birthing and then providing food, you know, so much Jing goes into that. And so that's the community coming together to replenish Jing for the mother is beautiful.
And that's the recurring theme that has come up again and again with our previous guest as well, is I would like to emphasize again of the revaluation. Here I'm speaking more like in a male dominant kind of language, so that some part of our society can understand it better, is reevaluate the value of a woman's contribution in the birthing process, right? So why do like modern women feel guilty? Is because part of the reason is because they cannot be economically productive when they are pregnant and giving birth, right? Because they can't go out and work, basically, and make the income. But that's ignoring the monetary value, the financial value of the birthing. We're saying the whole pregnancy and birthing is economically less valuable than you go out and work. So to me, that's what it seems to be saying. But in traditional society, that's not the valuation. The valuation is that is bigger than anything that this woman can do at that point. And the contribution, not just the emotional, the financial contribution this woman can give back to her society is much greater. Because right now we have a very simplistic valuation of a woman's contribution, right? You're just, you know, you're a money producing unit. How much money do we usually assign to a marriage, a relationship that is stable and loving? How much monetary value do we assign to children who grew up emotionally stable and don't get into trouble in school, and then do drugs and end up in juvenile courts? How much money do we assign to that? So kind of what I've been thinking along is maybe we can speak more to that. Not that women need that kind of valuation, but to speak more to more the male-dominated sphere of our society, that there's tremendous value in these kind of yin aspects, soft skill aspects, and soft benefits about this whole thing about having a calm and loving, nurturing home. Not the billions you would, you know, male dominated models would be, yeah, I made 100,000, then it's better if I make 1,000,000. Then it's better if I make 100,000,000, and even better, I make 1,000,000,000. That is the male way. More, 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 more. Numbers, numbers, number, numbers.
Leo, you're going to make me cry, because when I had my daughter, I got a divorce shortly after, because the father wanted, he was just a regular American guy, and he wanted to send my child, our child, to daycare so that I could finish up my doctorate and get back to work. And as a traditional German, I was like, there's no way in hell I'm taking my newborn baby and giving her up to childcare. And I stuck with that. I was like, there is no way, if I'm going to have a baby, nobody's taking that baby from me. And I'm so glad I stuck. And it was so hard as a single mom. And I see single moms or single parents who are doing exactly what you're saying, who are living by those values, or relationships. I just see how hard it is in our society, because our society does not, you're absolutely right, our society does not value that kind of work. It's just so... And it's just a few years. I mean, it's really just the first few years that are so important and so precious in that baby's life. And it just makes me so sad that, including Chinese medicine practitioners, like the school, the university where I used to teach, they had a rule that the woman was supposed to go back to school. They would give the woman 6 weeks postpartum. And then she was back. And this was a school of classical Chinese medicine. And it's like, talk about a mismatch in values. And you just don't, if you've never had a baby and you've never listened to somebody like us, you don't know what it does to your body to give birth or to breastfeed. You just have, like, I had no idea before I had my baby. What? Yeah, you're nodding, right?
I mean, I feel like many people can tell you what to expect and paint a picture, but you just don't know until you know.
Yes. And if you don't have, like, I had my mom in Germany, and my husband's mom was, I don't know, she was just not very, she was just not into being helpful. She was very clear. She was never going to change a diaper. That was like the first thing she did. She was like, I raised, you know, your husband. I'm done. I'm not interested in sacrificing anymore. And I think part of it is because in our culture, it is such a sacrifice to be a mom, because so many moms have to work part-time and there's no supportive structure around it. So raising kids is such a challenge that I have several friends my age and they're not interested in being grandmas, whereas I'm like, oh my God, I can't wait to change a diaper and be a grandma. But a lot of women are just so burnt out by the time they hit their 50s or 60s. Like, I'm not cooking another meal for the next generation. I'm done. It's, and that's where I'm like, you know, Chinese medicine is not just about treating the physical body. It's about treating the social body. It's about treating the cosmic body. It's exactly what you're saying, Leo, where we have I don't know, and I don't know how much of it is Chinese medicine and how much of it is just a traditional, a way of looking at the world that is different from the current standard modern global capitalist,
a non-male dominated
let's
call it that.
Like, I'm trying
it's very obvious.
Yeah, I'm always trying to disentangle how much of these conversations we're having, how much of it is Chinese medicine versus how much of it is just traditional or different from the current power over male dominated whatever paradigm of extractive economy, nuclear families, all of this stuff. It's hard to disentangle, but I feel like Chinese medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, or the classics, not just Chinese, classical Chinese culture, philosophy, because it's also Confucianism and Taoism and Buddhism. It's not just medicine to me. It's the whole, and maybe I'm orientalizing. Maybe I'm creating a fantasy world. But for me, there's something in the classics that is a helpful, that provides a helpful perspective on the ailments that our current culture is struggling with.
Yeah. I feel like we're kind of talking about a harmony between yin and yang, essentially. And that maybe for just so long we've kind of held yang as like this standard of being, like this is the best way of being or the best way to live life and to function in life. And that's kind of been maybe the dominant message for a long time. And maybe because of that, everybody's burnt out because we've just burnt through all of that or just abused that. So there's maybe it feels like a bit of disharmony. And so just a remedy to that is to bring a value system back to yin.
Rebalancing. Too much yang, right? And I don't know about our listeners, but being close to Silicon Valley really accentuate that imbalance. Yeah, because we are close to a culture or geographical region or industry that really value and look upon these, these geniuses, male geniuses who came out of nothing and then built and became a billionaire. Yeah, the stories of all these Silicon Valley startups. Right?
So but then that's the story of success. Like, that's kind of what
they
strive for.
Yeah. But what we don't talk about enough is the dark side. What happened to these people, their families, their children? Right? We have, for example, at Stanford, Anna Lamke, the professor of psychiatry and a clinician at Stanford, who treats a lot of really troubled children of these tycoons and these successful people who actually have no will to live. And she talks about it extensively in her book and in her podcast, in her interviews. These children were, they were born to these some of the most brilliant minds in the world and the most successful entrepreneurs in the world. How come these children are addicted and they do not have a will to live? You don't find that, like, jaw-dropping? And not talking just of children, but how many of these successful entrepreneurs, the ones that are just in the news, how successful these men became and how eventually they died prematurely. Some burned themselves to death in accidents. Some become so ill that they died in the eye of the public. So So that's what I meant by rebalancing the dialogue, the narrative. Because there's so much talk and admiration for the best companies, the most profitable company, the richest men in the world.
But then there is the Pebble in the Cosmic Pond podcast, rebalancing, straightening it all out. That's right. What we're doing.
And that's what I think we should be talking more about, is the rest of, you know, the family life, stability, nurturance, loving kindness, sweetness, play. And just listening to you both, I think there is a need for women like yourselves to even be more explicit and outspoken, not in an angry way, but an honest sharing way. I don't quite like the word outspoken or speaking out or speaking up or some. It's more like sharing. Sharing more and more sharing about the experience of birthing. Because what I can see immediately is how, for example, if Chris and Sabina, women like yourselves, start sharing more about the what it takes to be a birthing mother, more younger women perhaps will have a better idea before they step into motherhood what's needed. Do they have the sufficient emotional, financial, and social resources and support to actually have a child?
And that's where I feel like is a potential for Chinese medicine practitioners to change the culture. Because, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not a clinical practitioner, but that's... You are in a position of authority and power. You are the expert on the female body. And if you have female patients come to you, especially like young women and ideally, you know, the mother brings a teenage daughter and you help that girl through her first menstrual cramps, so she knows you know a little bit and you've helped her before and you develop a relationship and you just drop these little bits of knowledge of, like, you know, just something like little, like, oh, you got your period, and instead of saying, oh, where does it hurt, and instead of making it a negative thing, you're asking like, oh, how beautiful. That shows that your chi and your blood are in balance, and can you feel when you're bleeding that your senses, that your sense of smell is different, or can you feel more emotionally in tune when you're bleeding? Like asking, changing the, like asking girls or women questions that make them think about the experience of bleeding in from a different perspective. And if you can do that, I think a practitioner of Chinese medicine is kind of in a prime position. I mean, maybe I'm idealizing your power.
Oh no! I mean, I hold what's called like maiden circles in my community, where I teach them the Chinese medicine perspective about your heavenly water, and to kind of gain a relationship with their bleeding bodies or eventual bleeding bodies, and that it's
talk about
it's
that.
It's a tool for you to understand your health and for the rest of your life, you know. I think it's a huge opportunity that we have to share, you know.
Share more. Like I think that's where it's at. I totally so share with the teach our listeners how to do that. Would you?
Oh,
or is it a professional secret?
You know what? It's so funny. I, you know, I have an Instagram account that I use for my business because I teach online courses to the public. And so I was in the grocery store, and a woman stopped me. And I almost felt like I was like a famous person. They're like, "Are you cool?" I'm like, "Yes. Do you teach classes on menstruation?" And I was like, "Yes." She's like, "Can you come teach my group of moms that all have 11-year-old girls about menstruation?" And I was like, "Absolutely." Yeah. So I just created this really short, approachable, fun, artistic way to teach them about their heavenly water, their cycles, and related to inner seasons, like how we talked about in the last segment. And they're so responsive. You get kind of giggles and some faces that are kind of looking side to side, like, "Oh my gosh, what are we talking about here?" But it brings it into grasp, their understanding of what's eventually going to happen, and it demystifies it, and it empowers them to understand that this is like a vital sign that you can tune into for the rest of your life. That's going to tell you how you're doing on a monthly basis. It's like a report card. And so I feel like when you frame it in that way, it's not so scary. It's not this burdensome thing that happens every month. It's a way for them to early on kind of tune in, like, "Oh, I had a really painful period the last time. You know, what do I need to do to try and shift that? 'Cause I can." Yeah, so that's a really fun thing that I do on occasion, is just hold maiden circles.
I used to have a big suitcase, and I went to the used bookstore in Tucson, and my daughter was like, I think she was 9 at the time or so, and we bought a bunch of books on menstruation for girls, and I had a suitcase full of these books, and then I had it wasn't raspberry leaf tea, but it was like raspberry tea, like a celestial seasoning. So it was a red tea that tasted really good. And we had raspberry chocolate. And that was, and I used to have these classes in my daughter's little alternative Waldorf type in her middle school.
Oh, I love that.
It was great. It was so fun.
I mean, that's beautiful, because I feel like that's what Chinese medicine does through the 7-year life cycles and the 8-year life cycles, is that it highlights these rites of passages that we no longer honor anymore. Because like how Leo was saying, is like, we want to stop everybody in this period of time and like keep everybody in our 20s and this perpetual kind of going back in the cycle to always want to be how we are in our 20s or in our 30s. And we're like working against these bigger cycles of life that are forever pushing us forward, and that change is coming. Change is always here, but we're constantly trying to fight against that. And that's, I think, what harms our jing and harms our potential for vitality, is when we're going against the grain. And I love how the conversation really kind of shifted into yin and yang, which is like such a huge part of our medicine, and that we're not really necessarily talking about men versus women, but we're really talking about like femininity and masculinity and yin and yang. And one story that I have is that, maybe our household is a little non-traditional, in that my husband is a very domestic creature. Like, he is the most amazing baker and cook, and embodies this very kind of balanced masculine feminine mix. And so when I was healed postpartum. I was the career person. I had an acupuncture degree, and he was still kind of working on his schoolwork. So I was the one after healing to go to work, where he was at home caring for our young. I feel like there's something to learn about that we all embody both yin and yang, femininity and masculinity. And I feel like what Leo's encouraging in maybe individuals that feel most comfortable in the femininity, that it's okay to embody the masculine qualities and using your voice and sharing. And I love like the conversation of everything that we're kind of talking about, that really feels like we're kind of swimming in Chinese medicine.
How beautiful. I just want to add a little bit more of a observation or comment, in that I think there something that's worth pointing out is sometimes how medicine can get so heavy. It can get so fear-based, and there is a weight, a gravitas to the whole subject. And what I love about what you, Chris, just talked about is how you actually make light of the subject, not in a derogatory way, but in an enlightened way, how you depathologize and you re-empowered the girls. And you make it fun and you make it light. I think that is the restoration of the feminine. Right? To restore the feminine, or the feminine presence, the yin presence in our human society right now, to its fruitful place, to its beneficial place, so that the world is not so lopsided.
And you know, I feel like there's hope from my generation. I mean, I come from a very conservative family in Bavaria, but my daughter's generation, and Chris, you're a little bit younger, you have a different, I feel, especially my daughter is 26 now. She, for her, sex is, the sex that you're born with is not, the male and female bodies are not, we are now able to look at the human body as a yin and yang combination, instead of as a male versus a female, like instead of these boxes. And I think when I was I was still raised where I was in the female box. I was defined by my female body, and I was supposed to marry a man, and the man was going to support me. And I chose to reject that, and yet I am also a very feminine person. That's just, that's part of who I am, and I love having a female body. So I had a baby, and then I switched into yang mode, and I was stronger than all my neighbors in running the goat farm and throwing 100-pound hay bales around. And at one point, my body completely collapsed because I was acting as if I were a man without really, and I was so unconscious of everything that was going on, but it was like I had to be tougher than all my neighbors, and I was on my own, and blah, blah, blah. And it was so unhealthy. And that's what I always loved about my friend Lillian, who died, that she was so feminine, and she always had the high heels until the end. And until she learned on the cobblestones in Germany that high heels do not work on cobblestones. But Lillian always had the perfect lipstick. And yet she was an independent woman, a single mom. She was an amazing teacher. With your kind of, she embodied this yin power in a way I think I didn't know. I didn't, and I don't know where she learned that from. I didn't have any role models like that. So I'm getting there, but I think for a while I was just trying to do the yang power thing, And it was really not a healthy thing for me. And there is a healthy way of being powerful in a yin way that is that
yeah.
I feel like just the way you are being and the way family structures are changing with men raising the kids. And that gives me so much. And that's what I tell my daughter. It's like she no longer has pressure to have babies. She's not defined by her female body, but she can celebrate it. And at the same time, if you're a guy, you can run around in twirly skirts and put on the lipstick and do the same. You can... I feel like that gives me so much hope for our culture, even though I'm not really into the whole evolution thing, because I'm a Chinese, classical Chinese person, so I try and not think in the evolutionary model where, you know, we're always progressing, we're always better than those who came before us. I try to do the opposite. But maybe there is an evolution thing going on that gives me hope.
Yeah. I still stand, though, that there's like a fluidity. Yeah, because like one of the early things that we learn in school is that you have this duality, but then within each one, you have layers and layers and layers and layers. Yeah. Beautiful.
If you enjoyed this conversation, remember to subscribe to my newsletter at happygoatproductions.com/connect to get notified of future episodes and other offerings. And if you want access to the more specialized and truly nerdy conversations that Leo and I are having in the Imperial Tutorial, please take a look at my Imperial Tutor Mentorship, which you can find at my website at happygoatproductions.com/imperialtutor. Also, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and share our work with your friends and colleagues. And if you feel like it, continue the conversation for each episode on our Pebble in a Cosmic Pond Facebook group. Last, but definitely not least, go out there and spread some positive vibrations between heaven and earth. Goodbye.